in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Thursday, May 15th, 2014. And we've got Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute with us today. He's going to give us a sneak preview of an article he's got coming out next week, critiquing a recent piece in the Financial Times by Martin Wolf. We'll give you the details on that in just a minute. But let it suffice to say that this was a piece that amply deserved a refutation, and we're going to have fun doing that with Mark today. Mark Thornton is a senior fellow and resident scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Mises.org is the website, Mises.org. He is the author of The Economics of Prohibition, Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War, and The Quotable Mises. And he joins us right now from the Mises Institute. Mark Thornton, welcome back to the program.
Tom Woods, it's great to be here with you. It's great to be back on the show.
You've got a piece coming out next week as a Mises Daily at Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org, and we're getting a sneak preview of it here. It's about Martin Wolf, who is a chief economics commentator at the Financial Times, a very, very important position, who is, well, you know what? I'm not going to give away what it is that he's advocating. I want you to tell us, without editorial comment first, what it is that he thinks will lift the economies of the West out of the doldrums.
Well, his best solution that he thinks is most viable is if governments around the world went on a massive building campaign to build productive assets financed by huge government deficits. But he doesn't think governments have a mouth for that or have a taste for that. And so he's advocating a continuation for the foreseeable future of a cheap money policy that we already have, basically, of zero interest rates and quantitative easing. He believes that we should just shut up about that and accept it, because that's the second best solution available.
Now, I, as the average observer, might want to respond to Wolf with regard to his proposed large-scale building project with the counterexample of Japan, right? I mean, isn't that obviously what comes to mind, the enormous trillions of yen that they spent on these, on building programs, on fiscal stimulus of this kind, and their economy didn't really have a whole lot to show for that.
Tom, Japan is a perfect example. They've been at this Keynesian policy response, or this Keynesian policy solution of massive public works projects financed by huge government deficits now for almost 25 years. And they've spent a huge proportion of their budget on these public works projects. Someone said that they've virtually covered the entire country of Japan in concrete of one form or another. And the only thing they've really established is one of the world's largest government deficits, which now exceeds 200% of GDP. And most economists pin the beyond the point of no return level at about 100%. So if you're government debt is 100% of your GDP, you're considered teetering into, a very bad economic path. And Japan has over 200% of government national debt versus their GDP. So that proposal for reforming the economy, for stimulating the economy, in the case of Japan, has proven just disastrous, and it could bring the Japanese economy down significantly going forward. But it's also true that these public works projects have never worked in any country that's tried them. It's just never panned out. We tried that here in the United States during the Great Depression, and yet the Great Depression continued on for many, many more years to come. So public works spending, deficit spending, these projects never stimulate an economy, and they're usually not really worth very much once they've been completed. They're basically, you're just spending and wasting money.
Well, of course, they're politically determined, so there's no profit and loss test. So, of course, they're going to be arbitrary to one degree or another. And the way I always think of it is you can spend some money on a building project, like, say, for a bridge, but when that project is over, there's still no job for the bridge builder on the other side of that bridge. Like, this is, at best, a temporary expedient. And Bob Murphy has argued that, in fact, it actually makes things worse because it's siphoning off resources from elsewhere in the economy. They claim, the Keynesians, that since resources are idle, we can just engage in these sorts of building projects without any consequences. But not all resources are idle, and you are going to have to pull some resources away from other projects to get them into these. So there are all kinds of issues related to that. But Wolf doesn't seem to hold out much hope that this is going to happen anyway. So maybe we should focus more attention then on his second best solution, as you said, which is the continuation of the low or zero interest rate and easy money policy. Now, as you indicated, Mark, that really has been the default position, certainly in the United States, for, well, I don't know, a number of years now, and the results have been fairly lackluster. But at the same time, somebody like Wolf could say, they may have been lackluster, but at least you're not seeing Great Depression Part Two, and that's at least something.
Yes, well, he's a Keynesian, and he's afraid of deflation, and so he doesn't want to go that route where the economy is allowed to proceed at a pace with using the price system to restore economic stability. He wants to stimulate the economy with easy money and government spending to keep everything where it is, when in fact, from the Austrian perspective, the economic bubble that preceded the economic crisis really moved labor and capital out of the places where they were needed most and demanded by consumers. And so Austrians realized that in order to get the resources of capital and labor back in the right places, you have to allow the price system to do its work. And that involves deflation, and that's what Keynesians are deathly afraid of. But if you think about it, Tom, if we allow deflation, what's going to happen? Well, capital prices, stock prices, land prices, they're all going to fall significantly. And labor prices are going to, as unemployment builds up, is going to fall significantly. But consumer goods tend not to fall that much. The demand for those consumer goods, the basic, food, clothing, and shelter, the basic items that we buy in the store on a weekly basis, they tend to fall very, very slowly and not very much. And so if consumer good prices are relatively stable, yet labor and capital prices are falling significantly, that provides the opportunity for entrepreneurs to put that capital, to put that labor back in a different combination, put it to work producing consumer goods for a profit. And so the deflation that we see in an economic crisis involves the natural reluctance of entrepreneurs to buy inputs at the boom level prices. And so they sit on the sidelines and they wait for those prices to fall until they get to the point where they can put the capital and labor back together, working together profitably. And so, but that's what the Keynesians are afraid of. They're afraid of that deflation, which is an effect of entrepreneurs' reluctance to operate on the boom level prices.
Mark, I think even some free market people think that when you have easy money policy, that the main drawback of this is price inflation that hurts the average person. But that's only one aspect of the story. And they might come back and say that, in fact, price inflation, as measured by the CPI anyway, is not really all that great, so that's not worth worrying about. But you point out in this article that there are many other negative consequences for a number of institutions on which the middle class, in fact, the 99% so-called, rely. Insurance, pensions, and retirement savings accounts, etc. These things are all hurt by easy money policies. Can you talk about that?
Sure, and this is what makes my blood boil about Mr. Wolf, is that he actually understands this, and he actually points this out in his editorial. So he understands that an easy monetary policy hurts most people in society. Specifically, he points out that it hurts insurance, it hurts pensions, and it hurts households. And the only people that it benefits are the large corporations, the big banks, and government itself. And so, you know, it's just hard to imagine somebody advocating a policy that does that kind of thing and expects that to somehow heal the economy. But if we think about it, it makes perfect sense. Low interest rates are making it very hard, for example, for insurance companies to earn a rate of return on their investments that are going to be necessary to meet their policy obligations. And so insurance companies is just one example where they've had to go out and invest in riskier investments so that the return on those investments can keep up with their policy obligations. And the same is true with pensions. Pensions have had to go out and invest in riskier assets to keep up with their pension obligations. And when you think about it, most people have, insurance policies that protect their life, their home, their car, their health, their business. And most people have some kind of pension, whether it's public pension or private pension, or whether it's a retirement account that they manage themselves. And so this is impacting everybody in society, basically. And it's impacting us on a negative way because we're being forced into riskier investments that could go, could go bankrupt themselves. And as a consequence, this easy monetary policy is putting us all at risk. And now, so,
all right, but Mark, let me play devil's advocate. Couldn't I say though that in a genuine free market, let's say a complete Rothbardian free market, there, of course, wouldn't be any government debt at all. There'd be no government. There'd be no government bonds. There'd be no treasuries to buy. And in that environment, then these institutions would not have the safe haven of treasuries to put their money in the first place. They would have to go around assessing the relative risk, the continuum of risk across a variety of asset classes and investment projects. And they would have to take their chances according to their best estimates as to what's going to give them the best return versus the amount of risk that they're taking on. So the fact that easy money policy means that they're not getting as good of a return on their investment in U.S. treasuries, well, okay, but U.S. treasuries are a non-market institution to begin with. So by, in effect, taking away this option from them, aren't we kind of restoring the free market?
Not exactly. The lower interest rate by the Fed reducing the interest rate on government securities also has the same effect on all marketplaces.
That's what I want you to develop. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So, corporate bonds, the yield on corporate bonds has fallen to near all-time lows. And the yield on junk bonds has come down significantly as well, so that you, even if you're investing in junk bonds, you're only earning about 6% interest. And with the default rate on junk bonds, particularly if the economy gets worse or the stock market goes down, you could end up with significant losses on those investments.
So what? But what's the causal relationship here? Why should the federal government's easy money policy? I can see what it would do to treasuries, but what's the relationship between that? How does that affect these other types of investments?
Well, when you go take your money into the investment markets and you look at, for example, savings accounts, certificates of deposit, money market mutual funds, things that used to yield a real return, they're yielding less than 1%. And you have to pay taxes on that. and you also are subject to losing purchasing power due to inflation. And so you're actually losing purchasing power by putting your money in those assets. So many, many more people are putting them in things like, first of all, they went to corporate bonds, and as people piled money in there, the yield on corporate bonds falls. Recent corporate bonds by major corporations, 10-year corporate bonds are yielding only about 2%. And so, they've gone up the risk ladder into junk bonds, and as more money piled into junk bonds, the yield on those junk bonds declines. And so basically what the Fed has done by making these safe investments unattractive with such low yields is it's forced everybody to put money in riskier markets, and particularly into the stock market. Retirees have been investing in dividend-yielding stocks, and those dividend-yielding stocks therefore go way up in price. And so the Fed has, in fact, inflated a stock market bubble and a bond bubble through these policies. And so the net effect of all these easy monetary policies has not been able to get us out of the economic quagmire, but it has created economic bubbles in the stock market, the bond market, land prices, and many other things.
You say in your article the winners from easy money policies are the government, non-financial corporations, and large banks in the United States. Now, it may be obvious, for example, why the government benefits from this. Maybe all these things are obvious, but it couldn't hurt to spell it all out.
Right, and that's based on a study that Wolfst cites himself from the International Monetary Fund, and this is true not just in the United States, but in other major countries as well. Inflation, low interest rate policy, of course, helps borrowers. They get to borrow money at about 1%, basically, rather than 5%. And so the government is one of the biggest borrowers. And so its policy makes it cheaper for government to sell its debt. And inflation, reducing the purchasing power of the dollar over time, means that government can pay back that debt with depreciated dollars. The same is true for large corporations. They can borrow money cheaply, just like government, and they can hope to pay it off with depreciated dollars later on. So the borrowers are helped by low interest rate policy in both ways. They can borrow cheaply, and they can hope to pay it off in greatly depreciated dollars down the road. So it's a great deal for them. And, of course, for banks, that's their raw material. It's like the federal government is subsidizing the raw material for banks. Banks can borrow the money from the Fed and re-lend it out into the economy at a very large spread between their cost and what consumers and entrepreneurs have to pay the banks to get that money. It'd be like the government subsidizing flour for bakeries. It just makes everything easier and more profitable. And we've seen the stocks of banks, particularly big banks, increase dramatically through this economic crisis.
Let me read a couple quick passages from your article. The idea that easy money policies can cause economic bubbles and that those bubbles will lead to sustainable increases in investment, consumer spending, and increased aggregate demand is fallacious. Harming the workers and savers of society to benefit the ruling class is no way to get the economy back on track. Modern monetary policy is a scam of gigantic global proportions. Achieving economic recovery and growth requires first knowing what caused the problem in the first place. And a lack of aggregate demand is the effect, not the cause. A lack of aggregate demand is the crisis, not the cause of it. The cause of the crisis is easy money policy and runaway government spending and debt. And then you go on to say that continuing that is just going to intensify the problem. And then toward the end, you give us what the solution would be. Now, just come right out and tell us, I don't care about the political feasibility of it. That's of no interest to me. I want to know intellectually, if we could do the right thing, what would the right thing be?
Well, it's very basic, and this could be done mostly on an immediate basis. And the first one is for central banks to have no monetary policy at all, to have no interference with interest rates. And the Fed could essentially do that with a drop of a hat. It could do that instantaneously and allow markets to take over, interest rates to rise, and for the economy to normalize, for savers to get a return, and so on. The second thing is that government should balance its own budget and reduce it over time. So the government should balance its budget without tax increases, and that budget should be reduced over time as quickly as possible. The third thing is to eliminate regulations, subsidies, and taxes on the economy. Eliminating just a small number of regulators can result in a huge increase in the number of jobs throughout the economy and increasing GDP by a tremendous amount. So every regulator we have in the federal government holds back the economy, and subsidies and taxes do the same thing. We should also transfer resources from the government to the economy. All the kind of land that the government owns, labor and capital, should be transferred from the public sector to the private sector. The federal government has like 54,000 buildings that are unoccupied and could be used by the private sector. And also, of course, we should either eliminate or begin to eliminate all programs that burden future generations, because young people these days, you know, they're looking out and they're seeing this tremendous national debt, problems with Social Security, and they're very discouraged. And a number of my students have considered or have actually moved out of the country because they don't think the United States is the land of the free and the future of prosperity.
Mark, I can't help asking before I let you go if you might tell us something about this debate that you're preparing for at Oxford on the subject of drug legalization. What are the circumstances? Is there a group over there that invited you? Is it a team debate? Who's in it? When's it going to be? And will we be able to see a video of it?
Well, it's the Oxford Union debate. It's one of the oldest competitive debating societies in the world. Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, the Dalai Lama, Sister Teresa have all participated in debates at the Oxford Union. And so I'm thrilled to do it. And I think now is the time to... you know, to put an end to the war on drugs. I don't know exactly the parameters of how many people we will be debating or who my opposition is, but I feel very confident that I can win the debate. I think the case against the war on drugs is not only obvious, but it's become increasingly understood by more and more people that the war on drugs is not just costly, but it's actually counterproductive. And the debate will be held in the first week of June, and it will be available to watch and listen to shortly thereafter on YouTube. So I'm very excited about it, and I think it's a very encouraging sign that organizations like this have started to look at it seriously in terms of not just manipulating the war on drugs in one way or another, but in terms of eliminating it entirely and taking the law enforcement approach and the military approach to the problems of drug abuse off the table.
Well, Mark, we are all looking forward to this. It's thrilling. I can't wait to see it, and I wish you the best of luck. Of course, you've been writing about this and talking about this for a very long time, so I have absolute confidence in your ability to represent us honorably there. So good luck with that, and thanks for your time today talking about Martin Wolf. I mean, my gosh, the last name Wolf. We could make all kinds of jokes about wolves and sheep's clothing, but the thing is he'd have to put sheep's clothing on in the first place. I mean, he's just an open wolf, the guy.
Oh, yeah. It's just monstrous, Tom. Absolutely monstrous.
Thanks again, Mark.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody, check out the Mises Institute, of course, MISES.org. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about that book, Capital in the 21st Century, that hit number one on Amazon. Very rare for a book on economics. We're going to have Bob Murphy with us to talk about it. This is by popular demand. You guys have wanted us to cover this topic. It's coming tomorrow. So make sure you're a subscriber of the program. Subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. You'll find easy links to do that at the show site, which is TomWoodsRadio.com. Don't forget, I'll be speaking in Boston on June 2nd. And in St. Paul, Minnesota, June 19th. Oh, also Nashville, Tennessee, August 15th. Get the details on those events at TomWoods.com. That's my personal site, TomWoods.com/events. See you tomorrow, everybody. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.